Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Electoral Count Act of 1887 was an obscure, confusing, but mostly uncontroversial law that governs how Congress and the vice president count presidential electoral votes. It was mostly uncontroversial, that is, until January 6th, 2021.
What an absolute disgrace that this could be happening to our Constitution. And I hope Mike is going to do the right thing. I hope so. I hope so. Because if Mike Pence does the right thing, we win the election. All he has to do, this is from the number one, or certainly one of the top, constitutional lawyers in our country. He has the absolute right to do it. We're supposed to protect our country, support our country, support our Constitution, and protect our Constitution. All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people.
Then President Donald Trump, on January 6th, 2021, just hours before a mob, including people who listened to that very speech, ransacked the Capitol building and temporarily stopped the electoral count. Some in that mob chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." As you know, when congressional proceedings restarted hours later, Pence performed his duty and did not overturn the presidential election. So since then, a couple of things have happened, especially over the past few days. Things that have added urgency to a movement on Capitol Hill now to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887. First, we should note that on Friday, the Republican National Committee voted to censure Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for participating in the congressional investigation into the attack of January 6th. In the text of the censure, the RNC called those arrested for the attack political prisoners, and that the violence and destruction at the Capitol was, quote, legitimate public discourse. It was not. And last week, Trump released a statement with his clearest language yet that he sought to illegally seize the presidency last year. Quote, "Mike Pence did have the right to change the outcome. Unfortunately, he didn't exercise that power. He could have overturned the election," the statement reads. Quote, "How come Democrats and Rhino Republicans are desperately trying to pass legislation that will not allow the vice president to change the results of the election?" End quote. Well, on Friday, Trump received an answer to that question from former Vice President Mike Pence.
"And I heard this week that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. But President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president."
Mike Pence speaking at a Federalist Society event in Florida on Friday. Well, J. Michael Luttig joins us now. He's a former judge who sat on the U.S. Fourth Circuit of Appeals. And on January 6th, 2021, he advised Pence on his constitutional role in the electoral count. Judge Luttig, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me on your show today. It's a pleasure.
I wonder if we could start 2 days before January 6, 2021, around the 4th of January, because I have seen it reported that at that time you already found yourself enmeshed in a brewing constitutional crisis. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I did, Meghna. That came about in this way. On the evening of January 4th, after what we now know was the fateful meeting in the Oval Office between the president and the vice president, and John Eastman and Mark Short, the vice president's chief of staff, I received a call in the evening from Richard Cullen, who was at the time outside counsel to the vice president. Richard was a longtime and dear friend of mine, and he asked me what I knew about John Eastman.
Mm-hmm.
I told him that that John was a former law clerk of mine, and asked why he was asking, and he said that that John Eastman was advising the president and the vice president, that the vice president had the authority on January 6th to effectively overturn the presidential election. I had not known that Professor Eastman was advising the president until Richard Cullen told me that. The next morning, early, I was in Colorado at the time, early, around 6 a.m. Colorado time, Richard called me back and asked if there was anything that I could do to assist the vice president. I didn't at the time have even a thought as to what I could do. I didn't hold a position at all of any kind, and I had no way to broadcast, if you will, you know, my view that the vice president had no authority to overturn the election.
Judge Ludig, can I just happen, yes, for one second, just to clarify, when you say you didn't have a position that was on the election itself, you definitely have a strong constitutional position on the vice president's role during the electoral.
Yeah, yes, Magda. What I meant was I didn't have an official office or
understood,
position,
okay,
or and therefore a platform from which I could broadcast my view.
Understood. Okay.
Yes. I had a very firm view on the constitutionality of
Judge Ludig. We are going to work rapidly to get Judge Ludig back here because he has a lot more to say. Still dealing with internet problems in the age of COVID here. But can we turn now to Mark Joseph Stern? Yep, he is a Slate reporter covering the courts and the law, and he's with us from Washington. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Magna. Happy to be here.
Okay, so just to be totally transparent here, when we get Judge Ludig back, I'm going to turn back to him because I really want to hear the story about what happened between the 4th and the 6th of January of last year, Mark.
I do too.
Okay. But first of all, let's jump ahead while we're waiting to reconnect with the judge. And I'd love to hear from you. I mean, I open this hour. The reason why we're talking about this today is because there is this gathering momentum in Congress to make some reforms to the Electoral Count Act. So why don't we just start from the beginning? Is it what happened last year that's really pulling together what seems to be rare bipartisan support for some sort of action?
Yeah, absolutely. The events of last year, and especially of January 6th, really illustrated how dangerous the Electoral Count Act is because it's drafted so poorly and contains so many ambiguities. Now, for many decades, those ambiguities haven't posed a serious problem to our democracy because most elections were conducted in an orderly manner and the loser was willing to admit that he lost. Of course, 2020 was very different, and Trump and his associates tried to exploit these sort of cryptic terms in the law to insist that they could still win an election that they had lost by deploying Republican lawmakers and Mike Pence to essentially overturn the results of a handful of states that Biden carried.
Mm. Well, so why let's talk about why the law and this is pretty universal in terms of legal analysts that I've read. I'm sure that you've talked to, Mark, that when they say it is cryptic, right? Because it originates in 1887. If I have this correct, it's because of concerns in the Reconstruction period about Southern states and how they were sending electors in presidential elections. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So it has its origins in the contested 1876 presidential election, the Tilden-Hayes contest, where a number of states experienced real fraud at the polls and ended up sending different slates of electors to Congress, which had no idea how to deal with the problem. Congress took its time in the following decade in actually addressing this and laying down a blueprint for future problems, but eventually did come through with the Electoral Count Act. Whoever drafted it must have had a very sick sense of humor, because rather than actually clarifying the process here, it muddied the waters with a number of ambiguities, probably most importantly using the terms regularly given and lawfully certified, which seemed to suggest to some that perhaps Congress has a role here in actually deciding the election and rejecting the slate of electors sent by states. But if you look at the full context of the law, are actually just sort of bizarre and unusual ways of saying that Congress needs to go ahead and vote to certify these slates unless there is something egregious and objectively flawed in the way that a state conducted its election.
Okay, but so tell me a little bit more, though. I mean, take me deeper into some of the ambiguities, because understanding what those are going to help all of us understand why there's this belief for the need for reform now, 140 years later.
Right, exactly. So one of the phrases in the law says that Congress can reject electoral votes that are not regularly given. And another says that Congress can reject electors who are not lawfully certified. So step back and remember, this is the moment when officially the next president is selected. Under the 12th Amendment, Congress has to do something here to say, yes, we have examined the slates of electors and determined that the winner is the winner. And so the goal here was to give Congress some guidelines, but the law does not actually explain what it means for electoral votes to be regularly given or what it means for electors to be lawfully certified. Is that a subjective judgment call that Congress is supposed to make by itself? Is Congress supposed to launch an investigation? Is it supposed to use this moment to potentially overturn results certified by states and say our judgment is better than yours to the states? Nobody really knows the answer to those questions.
Well, Mark Joseph Stern with Slate, hang on here for just a second. We're going to take a quick break, and we've got Judge Michael Luttig back, so we'll hear more from him when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about gathering efforts on Capitol Hill to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And I'm joined today by Mark Joseph Stern. He's a reporter for Slate covering the courts and the law. He's with us from Washington. And we now have back Judge Michael Luttig, former judge on the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. He served on the bench there until 2006, and he advised Vice President Mike Pence on January 6, 2021, about the vice president's role in the Electoral Count Act. And Judge Luttig, I understand we have you back now. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Meghna, and I apologize.
No apology necessary. After 2 years of everyone having to deal with the new technical demands on us all, everything is forgiven. Now, Judge Luttig, before we have you pick up your story here, I want to emphasize some things to listeners. One is that You are considered a leading light amongst legal scholars in the United States. At one point in time, President George W. Bush considered you as a nominee for Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And in addition, as you had said earlier, from the 4th to the 6th, there was this very powerfully interesting sort of nexus of people, including John Eastman, who was advising President Trump and who wrote the memo that the public later saw that laid out this roadmap for a vice president to overturn an election. Turns out Mr. Eastman at one time was a former law clerk of yours. I can only imagine your surprise in finding his name on that memo. But and then in addition, it was the vice president's lawyer who had called you seeking advice. And you were telling us that on, what was it, the early hours of January 5th, I believe, the story picks up then. Can you
yes.
continue?
Go ahead. And then briefly, Magna, I decided eventually to tweet my advice. I had only gotten on Twitter, an account on Twitter, weeks before and didn't even know how to tweet a multiple or thread of tweets. But I decided that was the only way that I could speak publicly, which is what Richard Cullen believed the vice president wanted. So I tweeted the advice that is now publicly known.
Did you ever speak directly to the vice president?
I did not, Magna. Not until after January 6th, when on January 7th in the morning, I received a call from the vice president who thanked me for what I had done on January 5th.
Can we presume, though, that because you had been speaking to the vice president's lawyer, Richard Cullen, as you mentioned, that that beyond your tweet or even prior to your series of tweets, that that your advice had reached the vice president?
Yes. I only spoke on the 4th and the 5th with Richard Cullen, mm-hmm. who I understood was speaking directly with Mark Short, who I understood in turn was speaking with the vice president.
I understand. So now the reason why I wanted to get all these details clearly laid out for listeners is that on the 6th of January, on that morning, people might remember that Vice President Pence actually issued a letter to the Congress stating that he had no intention to overturn the election, and that he actually quoted you in that letter. I presume he was quoting the tweets that you had put out, right? Because he said in the letter, as former U.S. Court of Appeals Judge J. Michael Luttig observed, quote, "The only responsible power of the vice president under the Constitution is to faithfully count the Electoral College votes as they have been cast. The Constitution does not empower the vice president to alter in any way the votes that have been cast." So he actually cited you directly in the letter. And I presume that the back channeling was because the vice president felt like he needed conservative legal support to make the stand that he was going to make.
Yes, that's correct, Magna. And I was honored that the vice president asked me to for my counsel. I did not know at the time, and did not learn until the book by Woodward and Costa came out, what John Eastman's thinking had been. Once I learned that, I tweeted again that Professor Eastman was mistaken at every turn in his analysis.
We're going to get to the current proposals for the reform of the Electoral Count Act in a couple of minutes, but Judge Luttig, I have to say I am compelled by. Your story here and your analysis. So I cannot help this. I got to ask you a couple more questions. When do you know? Do you recall how long ago John Eastman was your clerk?
I do not, Magna, okay. But it would have been more than 20 years mm-hmm. ago, and perhaps as long ago as 25 years.
I see. And so, I mean, generally at that point in time, how closely were you working with the clerks? I mean, I'm just asking because what was your reaction when you heard that he was part of this effort to craft a legal rationale to overturn a free and fair election?
The relationship between a judge and his or her clerk is very, very close, Magna. And during the year that John Eastman clerked for me, we were, exceedingly close personally and professionally. When I finally, read what John's thinking, legal thinking was, I was surprised, and I was disappointed because I did not believe that there was any basis whatsoever in the laws or Constitution of the United States to contend that the vice president had the authority to overturn the presidential election, or for that matter, Magna, even to delay the counting of the vote on January 6th, as reportedly Mr. Eastman advised in the final days before January 6th.
Judge Luttig, if I may, I appreciate your judicious use of the words surprised and disappointed. I imagine that perhaps the actual thoughts you have are more pointed than that.
Yes, they are, Magna.
Fair enough. So a year later now, how much danger do you believe American democracy is in?
The New York Times editorialized over the weekend that it's not hyperbole that the future of our democracy depends on reform of the Electoral Count Act. I think that's correct. Last week, as you said, President Trump confirmed his past and present intent to exploit the ECA in 2024 if the need arises, giving urgency to the reform to reform of the ECA, which as yet is still in its nascency.
And so then, while we were trying to get you back on the line, Mark Joseph Stern from Slate gave us an excellent quick primer on the aspects of the Electoral Count Act that are most ripe for reform. A little later, we're going to hear from Senator Angus King on this. But where would you target specifically, Judge Luttig, in terms of places that you would change or aspects of the law that you would change?
Yes, I heard tail end of Mr. Stern's excellent description and explanation of the ECA, to whatever extent he suggested prior to my hearing him, that the focus should be on the objections that are permitted under the ECA to the electors and to the electors' count, votes. I believe, and have written that the ECA is unconstitutional to the extent that it gives Congress the power to decide the presidency in a host of circumstances where frankly, the Constitution and the framers of our Constitution never intended Congress to have such power. Congress is under the Constitution constrained to have a largely ministerial role in observing and witnessing the electoral vote count during the joint session of Congress on January 6th. That role is ministerial much in the same way that the vice president's role in opening the certificates and presiding over the count of them by the tellers in Congress is ministerial. Mm. So I believe that the surest way to prevent reoccurrence of another January 6th is for Congress to limit to the maximum extent possible the grounds for objection by Congress to electoral slates and their votes, and then likewise limit the ability of Congress to actually sustain those objections during the joint session.
Uh-huh. Judge Ludig, hang on here for a second, because I do want to turn back to Mark Joseph Stern. And Mark, thank you for listening along with us here to the judge. Some of the thoughts that have crossed your mind as you heard what Judge Ludig has been saying?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I would note, I didn't even discuss the reform of the vice president's role when we were talking earlier, because until very recently, that was not necessarily the most troubling aspect of this law. If you go and read it, it's one of the clearer components of the Electoral Count Act. I mean, the vice president is told to go stand in front of Congress and open these envelopes that have the slates of electors from each state. There is no indication whatsoever that he has the power to somehow set aside a slate of electors, lodge his own objection, or refuse certain electors because of his subjective judgment about how the voting went. This was a creation for this election that was, as you noted, really crafted by John Eastman and Trump together and deployed for the most nefarious of purposes. So this is one of the easier fixes for this reform bill. Just make it really, really clear that the vice president is basically a secretary for Congress at this moment. He has no substantive power whatsoever.
Well, you know, John Eastman and former President Trump have been successful enough in sowing questions and doubt about what you just said, Mark, that, I mean, we're getting comments from listeners who are asking right now, why would the Senate need to reform the Electoral Count Act if the VP wasn't able to overturn the count?
Well, I mean, that's sort of one of the beautiful things about having a Congress that is tasked with updating the laws of our nation. When it discovers that one certain law is not being implemented in the correct way, or that many folks are questioning the manner of its implementation, it can go back to the drafting table and say, you know what, we need to make this much clearer to ensure that it's carried out the way that we intended it to. Mm-hmm. And I think the Electoral Count Act reform bill that Senator King has introduced, the draft that we've seen online, does a great job just sort of filling out this sparse language from the original law and explaining that, no, the vice president really does not get to set aside an envelope. He is opening them and reading them and doing nothing more. And any attempt to do more would be not just undemocratic, but probably unconstitutional. Mm.
Well, Judge Ludig, we only have you for a couple of more minutes, and there's at least two questions I'd like to ask you. First of all, I've seen it that you think that, in fact, the best option right now would be to repeal the Electoral Count Act. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yes. I believe that's the single best. Mm. And that's because I believe, as I said, that it was unconstitutional for the 49th Congress 135 years ago to assume to the Congress the power to essentially adjudicate the disputes over the state electors' selection / election and their votes that are forwarded to the Congress for counting on January 6th. But Megna, let me respond to Mark. Again, he's exactly correct. The talking point about the need to reform the ECA it focuses on the ambiguity in the law. It's labyrinthian and confusing and therefore ambiguous. the former president and his allies and supporters and lawyers did not exploit the provisions of the ECA that are ambiguous. They exploited the provisions that are unambiguous. And those are the provisions that, in my view, are unconstitutional.
Okay. Judge Ludig, I have you for one more minute, only 60 seconds. And what you just said, though, I've got to ask. You're rightly pointing out about the how Donald Trump and his allies exploited the Electoral Count Act. But we're only in this place right now as a nation, largely because of the ideological capture that Trump has over the Republican Party. And so, in a sense, it doesn't matter what the law is. Do you believe that the Republican Party is a party that believes in the rule of law anymore?
I believe that the party as a whole certainly does. But I understand the concern, because to the extent that the former president still has a stranglehold on the party, then we have to take whatever steps necessary to prevent the reoccurrence of another January 6th. But while I believe that the act's unconstitutional, I'm realistic,
yeah.
And so I do favor proposals of the kind that Senator King,
right,
and Klobuchar and
have put forward. Yeah. Indeed. Well, Judge Michael Ludig, with that, I have to let you go. We're going to hear from Senator Angus King when we come back. Judge Ludig, thank you so much. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about efforts on Capitol Hill to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And I'm joined by Mark Joseph Stern. He's a Slate reporter covering the courts and the law. Before the break, you heard Judge Michael Ludig, a former judge on the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. At one time, he was also considered by President George W. Bush as a potential nominee for Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And we talked to him because January 4th, 5th, and 6th of last year, Vice President Mike Pence and his staff turned to Judge Ludig through back channels for advice on how to handle the pressures that Pence was receiving from Donald Trump to overturn the 2020 election. Well, so what are the specific reforms that are being proposed to the Electoral Count Act of 1887? Mark talked about them for a little bit, but they are being put forth by Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, along with Democratic Senators Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Dick Durbin of Illinois. They've drafted a proposal to changes they say are long overdue, including increasing the number of lawmakers in the House and Senate that need to support an objection to a state's slate of electors. Currently, it just takes one member of the House or Senate. The legislation would increase it to one-third of both chambers. It also increases the threshold for upholding the election, from upholding the objection put forth from a simple majority in both chambers to three-fifths in both chambers. So really increasing the threshold for how members of Congress can object to slates of electors put forth by states. Now, Senator King wasn't able to join us today. We spoke with him on Friday. And as we hinted a little earlier, he also talked about the one really big issue in particular that needs clarification in the Electoral Count Act once and for all.
we make clear that the vice president doesn't have any role other than a ceremonial role of opening the envelopes. And as you know, the former president put enormous pressure on Vice President Pence to use his term, overturn the election. That's not contemplated in the Constitution. It's not contemplated in the Electoral Count Act. But given our recent experience, it struck us as sensible to make that clear once and for all.
Mm. So on that last point, do you think that Donald Trump's press release, the one that you noted there, where he explicitly said that he wanted to overturn the election and wanted Vice President Mike Pence to do that? So I'm seeing a lot of different analyses of that that press release. Some people are saying that it might have galvanized key Republicans in particular to be more amenable to a reform to the Electoral Count Act. Others are saying that it's a distraction. And I'm just wondering if you can you give us sort of the inside take here? What impact did Trump's press release have on your fellow senators?
You're going to have to ask them.
Well, I'm sure you're talking with them, though, Senator King, though, right?
I mean, yes. I think it did to some extent underline the importance of getting this straight. By the way, former President Trump should stop and think for a minute that if he's so insistent on this, the person who will be in charge of this process in 3 years is one Kamala Harris. You know, she'll be the vice president that's in this role that he claims has the power to overturn the election. So the point is, we want to make this change now. It's nonpartisan. It shouldn't affect or help either side. But now's the time to do it rather than in the middle of a political campaign in 2024.
You know, I'm very much in support of any sort of institutional reform that can, you know, be a buttress to hold up American democracy. And at the same time, though, Senator, I mean, if we're frank with each other, reforms to the Electoral Count Act feel a little bit like bringing a water bucket to a 10-alarm fire. And part of the problem is that there are a lot of your fellow senators and members of the House who are standing around adding fuel to that fire. And if I'd go even so far as to say, like, I'm just thinking about a few days ago, Senator Susan Collins was asked by George Stephanopoulos if she would support Donald Trump if he ran again for president in 2024. And she basically wouldn't answer the question. She wouldn't even come out and say, no, I will not support him because he was impeached twice. He's admitted he wanted to overturn the 2020 election. I will not support him. She wouldn't even say that. So if we can't get established leaders in the Republican Party to say no to the number one force that's causing the breakdown of our democracy, what hope is there, Senator?
Well, I think the hope is that you take the steps that you can. You mentioned it's bringing a bucket to a 5-alarm fire, but if that fire is just smoldering, that bucket might be useful. I think the Electoral Count Act, as I said, I'm not arguing that it's the solution to all of these problems. I'm just saying it's something we got to do, and let's get that done and then see how much further we can go. This is a very dangerous moment. If people lose confidence in elections as a way to resolve our major issues, what's left?
That's Maine's independent Senator Angus King. He spoke with us on Friday. Now, in addition to King's efforts, there's also a bipartisan working group led by Republican Senator Susan Collins, also from Maine, and Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. They're working on changes to the Electoral Count Act. Here's Senator Manchin on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday.
What really caused the insurrection? They thought there was a kind of ambiguity, if you will, and there was an avenue they could go through and maybe overturn the election, because there was. It was not clear. And when one congressman and one senator can bring a state's authentic count to a halt, it's wrong. And basically not protecting the electors, and you can change electors before you send them here, after the election, all these things. This is what we're going to fix. And we have a group right now that's continuing to grow.
Yeah,
we're 16. Over probably 15 to 20 people that want to be part of it now.
So do you think it's going to pass?
Oh, I think absolutely it'll pass. Now, there'll be some people saying it's not enough. There'll be other people saying that it's more than what we should do or we don't need it. And what we'll do is try to bring them all together and say, listen, this is what we should do because this is what caused the problem and it's what we can do. So let's do that.
Senator Joe Manchin on CNN on Sunday. Mark Joseph Stern, let me quickly turn to you. How much alignment is there between the what sounds to me now like various proposals for ECA reform?
There is a lot of alignment between these bills. And the truth is that a lot of lawmakers have looked at this issue in the past, even before 2020, as part of kind of basic housekeeping that Congress does do from time to time, bringing old, decrepit, weirdly worded laws up to contemporary standards. And so when Manchin and Collins and Murkowski decided to launch this effort, they weren't starting with a totally clean slate, and that's absolutely fine. The basic goal of all of these measures is the same. Raise the threshold so that frivolous objections cannot bring the process to a halt and ensure that the vice president does not have any substantive power over the outcome of the count.
Well, let's bring Norm Eisen into the conversation now. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, was special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during the first Trump impeachment, and recently wrote in the Washington Post that fixing the electoral count is no substitute for real election reform. Norm, welcome back to On Point.
Magna, so nice to be back with you.
So, you know, you heard Senator Manchin there in that clip from yesterday saying some people may think this is not enough. That's you're one of those people.
Well, Magna, what Senator Manchin said respectfully was not true, that efforts by Mr. Trump and his allies to exploit ambiguity in the vice president's role is what caused the insurrection. No. That's a symptom, not the cause. The cause was the big lie and the root and branch attack by the Republican Party on our elections. It started with Trump and his cronies and has spread and metastasized throughout the party, as you pointed out earlier just this weekend, saying that the January 6th attack was legitimate political expression. That's why I disagree with, of course, as I wrote in the Post, yes, we need to fix the thresholds under the ECA for objections and for upholding objections. We need to clarify the vice president's role. But there's a much larger context here. And I have to disagree with Judge Luttig, again, respectfully. And he was a hero for what he did in 2020. He says, in answer to your question, the party as a whole certainly does continue to support free and fair elections and democracy. No, the party unanimously voted, Magna, to say that the attacks, the violent attacks of January 6th, were legitimate political expression. So my point in the Post with the dean of Washington reformers, Fred Wertheimer, yes, the ECA needs to be fixed. But, and you alluded to this in some of your questioning of Senator King, there's a much vaster problem here, which is, Magna, in last year alone, 262 bills, the organization that I co-chair, bipartisan, former GOP governor Christy Todd Whitman is my co-chair, States United. 262 bills we cataloged were introduced in 41 states and 32 laws enacted in 17 states, allowing state legislatures to politicize, criminalize, or interfere with elections. Hundreds of other racially discriminatory bills, voter suppression rampant from coast to coast. That is the crisis. That is the house of fire. And these ivory tower musings over the ECA, or Senator Manchin's pretty words, forgive me, are obscuring that vast crisis. And that's why, Magna, over 60 civil rights groups wrote and said, you can't do ECA, you can't put out that one little issue without addressing this vast coast-to-coast problem.
Yeah.
And remember, this is one bill that would affect one election every 4 years. This epidemic of hundreds of bills that I'm talking about from coast to coast affect every voter in every election for federal or other office or state office, and particularly the new Jim Crow, the racial discrimination. No, I'm not going to ignore all that. ECA reform must be considered in that context.
Okay, so Norm, let me just jump in here. First of all, you know, it's interesting that another thing that Judge Luttig said was that it wasn't even the ambiguous parts of the Electoral College Act that that Donald Trump sought to exploit. The Electoral Count Act. Thank you for the correction. It was the unambiguous parts, in his word, meaning that the audacity was sufficient, was so overwhelming that the parts that should have been the clearest were the ones that Trump and his supporters went after, which I think is actually it's important to say because of the following reason. I completely hear your passion and reason around the need for protection of democracy at multiple levels in this country. However, the Congress of the United States now has proven multiple times that passing those kinds of reforms is just outside of its ability. And so they're doing what they can. And right now, what they can is the ECA.
Well, Meghna, first of all, there's no real dispute. There's no serious dispute about the arguments Trump was making that Pence could overturn the election. And no matter what you do to the ECA, and I support ECA reforms on the thresholds, as I've said, and clarifying the role of the VP, but there's no dispute. I co-wrote a report on January 4th, again, for the State's United Democracy Center, the Guide to the Counting Electoral College Votes, that made clear the vice president couldn't do this stuff. No matter how you reform the ECA, Trump and his ilk, because they are fundamentally anti-democratic. And the Republican Party has slipped over with this unanimous resolution embracing January 6th. Judge Luttig was wrong about that, and that's a critical error, and it goes into Senator Manchin's reasoning as well. We can't count on the usual kind of bipartisan cooperation. Who's to say that this will ever happen? It's like Lucy and the football, Meghna, from a party that is so fundamentally hijacked. And that's not to say every person, but as far as I know, the only senator to condemn that resolution was Mitt Romney. There may have been others. I didn't see it. There certainly wasn't a chorus of condemnation. So I think all of that context has to be considered as we discuss this subject. And the last point I want to make to you, there is a great national debate going on. It was queued up. We need to continue that debate and not just say, oh, new Jim Crow election hijack and sabotage from coast to coast, hundreds of bills. Oh, we're going to ignore that. We'll have a nice little conversation about the ECA. No, think of it this way, Meghna. All of us, the people of this country, hundreds of millions of us who are affected by these terrible larger laws, we need to insist that these larger protections be included. That's part of the negotiation that will go on in Congress. So I think we need to be very loud and clear about that. But as I said in the Post, I do think in that context, ECA reform is one of many things that must be considered. If we're quiet, then they'll never, these GOP stalwarts who have gone over to the dark side, there's no hope at all. So we need to be very loud about the crisis that we're facing.
Now, just to be clear, when you said it was only Senator Romney that spoke out against the measure, you're talking about the censure, the RNC censure?
Yes, okay. I checked before I came on. I could only find one Republican senator who spoke out against that. Maybe there are others.
Yeah, I think seeing that Senator Murkowski put out a tweet.
Two. Yeah. But there's 50 of them, Meghna. Where's the other 48? And that is the party that we're supposed to, oh, let's move on. Our house is afire. The body politic has this metastasized. Oh, let's move on and talk about the little ECA fixes. I support those fixes, but we've got a much larger crisis in this country.
So Norm, hang on, because Mark, we've got 30 seconds, and I do want to give you a last word here. When the rubber meets the road, Mark, are there actually 60 votes in the Senate to support any kind of overhaul of the Electoral Count Act?
I think that there are. I think that enough senators see how this law is a loaded gun that could be aimed at either party in any future election to inflict mass disenfranchisement by throwing out millions of votes. And so I am cautiously optimistic that some kind of meaningful reform will pass and address at least one of the many problems that Norm just laid out for us.
Well, Mark Joseph Stern, Slate reporter covering courts and the law. We have a link to Mark's reporting at onpointradio.org. Mark, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And Norman Eisen, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, his op-ed in the Washington Post. We've also got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Norm, thank you so very much as always.
Thanks, Magna. Appreciate it.
This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.